from CNN's United Shades of America, host W. Kamau Bell. Mathematician, musician, and author Eugenia Cheng. And live music in Studio 435 from Chicago's Panda Riot. Now, here's your host, a man who over the weekend started the shirtless summer of 2017, Justin Kaufman.
Real strong. And as I get older, it used to be like, oh, nice little tuft of hair, on the chest. I could walk around with a shirt in the back pocket. Now, there's just hair everywhere. It's no good. It took probably about 3 minutes for me to be shirtless outside in the heat on Saturday. I'm like, I'm going for this look. And every insecure buzzer went off in my head. The first time somebody walked past, a double take? What are you doing? And I was like, this is what you do, man. It's the Midwest. It's 90 degrees. Spring awakening.
Conversely, I was on a I'm done with wearing shorts out in public kick.
Are you now just pants or no pants? Nothing.
I'm an adult in my 40s. I just can't wear cargo shorts anymore. I have to wear pants. That lasted until Saturday afternoon. Oh, I was like, I can't do it.
And even now, looking outside right now on Michigan Avenue, lots of people coming by with the short shorts. So maybe the problem, Pete, is the cargo shorts got to go, but the short shorts, they got to come back. 630 just says, hair everywhere? Come on, dude. We've seen your picture. It's because I'm bald on the top, and then I have a beard. So good point. I'm sorry. You nailed it, guys. You nailed it that I was fronting. No, I was talking. That was not the hair I was referring to. I was referring to it's not even back hair or bottom back hair. It's side hair. Now I'm starting to get hair here, which is just, that's when you get in your 40s where you're like, there's hair on the side stomach. That's when you're like, what is that? What's happening? So quickly I put a shirt back on. I'm like, I don't know if Chicago's ready for the side hair. The early June side hair coming out. So it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up. We have, accidentally kind of ran into a little bit of a theme. Infinity tonight. Dr. Eugenia Cheng will be here. She is the author. She is a mathematician and a musician as well as a chef. Her book is called Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. We will talk to her about math phobia. Talk to her about infinity and what we need to do to live a more realized math life. How about that? This is a great, great segment for me because I really don't like math. There's a lot of segments. We have a very diverse array of things that we can talk about, topics. Math, if you've paid attention to the download, not one I usually get into. No, it's not something where I'm like, we're talking sports, then we're going to talk hip hop, then we got a little math. It's just usually not in the wheelhouse. But tonight it is. Eugenia Cheng will be my guest later in the show. W. Kamau Bell's here tonight. The man who hosts United Shades of America on CNN is coming to the Park West this weekend. So we'll talk with him about his career, the show on CNN, and of course his stand-up, which we'll be seeing on Friday. Also tonight, Panda Riot, the dream pop band, will be live here in Studio 435. So we got a big show. We're also going to talk artisanal bread and the revitalization of the grain economy. That's industry night tonight. That's cool, right? That's interesting. It's a place up in Evanston, Hune. We'll talk with Ellen King, who's one of the co-owners, about trying to revitalize the grain economy here in Chicago in the Midwest. And then, of course, Touche, Chris Roebling, and Dave Lundy back together tonight. They're going to argue about everything. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download. A show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. We got you till 11 o'clock tonight. I'm very excited about the show, so let's get it started with the carryout. All right. Here are today's top stories. Just another day in the historical history of the History, White House. Oh, history. Today, the state of Maryland and Washington, D.C. sued President Trump on anti-corruption charges, saying he's violating the Constitution by essentially making money off of being president. Remember how he said he was going to stop running his business empire as president? Well, according to the suit, he hasn't. And this is a violation of the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution. The suit focuses on the Trump Tower in D.C., the hotel, which is renting out rooms to foreign dignitaries who allegedly want to curry favor with the president. And in doing this, they are requesting, dun-dun-dun, his tax returns. That's right. I, for one, I want to see the president's tax returns just so I can see if he checks the box to give a dollar to charity. And I wonder, I just wonder if he's using the 1040 EZ or if he's a 1040 guy. You know, it's a big difference, blue or pink. There's a lot of questions unanswered. Big difference. And then you add to that another judge upheld the freeze on the president's travel ban based on his past tweets. Yep, that's the reason. So add it up here. President Trump was sued and his foreign policy was affected by his past social media. Great. I mean, they tell college kids to be careful about what they put on Facebook. So what's next? Are we going to see pictures of Trump doing keg stands, smoking weed at a frat party? Or that's already happened, right? I think we already saw that. With that being said, Trump had a big loyalty rally today. I mean, cabinet meeting, where he touted that he has accomplished more than any other president besides FDR in his first 100 days. We'll talk about that coming up on Touche. President Trump is heading to Wisconsin tomorrow. It's going to be hot, so I hope they let him drink from the bubbler. See, I could speak Wisconsin just like you. Attorney General Jeff Sessions testifying about Russia in front of the Senate committee, and he wants it to be open. It was supposed to be closed, but he wants it open because he's got nothing to hide. So open. But you know what? Some things are better closed. Senate hearings, for one, and also bathroom stalls, right? Better closed. Because now I feel like Sessions is going to be that guy who talks while he's taking care of business. What have you guys been up to? I'm not having this conversation. Democrat Congressman Mike Quigley is doing bits. He wants the president's tweets to be part of the presidential record. He introduced a new act called the Communications Over Various Feeds Electronically for Engagement Act. For short, COFEFE. Remember that stupid word, COFEFE? Yeah, he's doing bits often. This could potentially make it illegal for the president to delete tweets since it would be on the record at all times. I mean, why? Why not? Nice to see Quiz getting some viral coverage for a kicker story, though. Real strong. And tonight, a Democratic congressman. You did it. You made the kicker story. Good job, buddy. Go Illinois. Bill Cosby's on trial for rape. It's gone to the jury already because he did not testify on his own behalf. So we'll see what happens. All I know is if convicted and goes to jail, pudding pops may not mean what it used to mean. Can't be the first pudding pop joke. Kind of low-hanging fruit, but what can you do? In weather, so hot. Just like instant dehydration, right? Actually, Chicago is hotter than Phoenix right now, or even Egypt. Yep. But, I mean, we've got the riverboat tour. What's Egypt got? Tour of the pyramids? Give me a break. Can you have beer on that tour? Probably not. But we have no fear because the thunderstorms are coming through tonight, and they're going to last throughout the week, or at least that's what my iPhone tells me. So my guess is, just from recent memory, it's going to be nice and sunny. In sports, the Cubs won yesterday, but they still lost the series at Wrigley to the Rockies. Not a great showing for a Cubs team who seems to have trouble with good teams. That's essentially the Cubs' problem this year. You know what their problem is? Good teams beat them. You know, you don't say. The Cubs did get some home runs yesterday from Schwarbs, Russell, and Zobrist. So maybe the bats are coming alive after the cruddy weekend. The Cubs are game back, and they sit at 500. They're out in New York tonight to play the Mets. Jacob deGrom is on the mound. I know this because he's on my fantasy team. So if the Cubs can't rough him up for 7 earned like every other team has this year, then the Cubs are definitely in trouble. As I look right now, they're losing 4-0 in the 5th. deGrom is shutting them out. Ugh! Come on, man. Also, the Mets. I know deGrom is on that team and there's the other pitchers, but I couldn't tell you any of the guys who are playing on this squad. And does David Wright still play for the Mets? Is Wally Backman plays second base? How about Bobby Ojeda? Is he still a third starter on this team? How about Hojo? Is Hojo? Howard Johnson, is Hojo playing third? And after a 2-7 road trip, the White Sox have rightfully claimed what's theirs, and that's the bottom of the AL Central. They're now 7 back and 1.5 back of the surging fourth-place Royals. The Sox now have a mini little set with the Orioles at the G-spot. The Orioles are playing well this year. Although, again, I just don't know too many guys on that squad. Right? I know Manny Machado, but I think he's hurt. They got Chris Davis. But after that, I don't know. I know Cal Ripken retired, but is Billy Ripken still playing? Who's in center? Is Lee Lacy still in center? How about Tippy Martinez? Oh, yeah. Is he still closing? Been waiting to say Tippy Martinez for a while. LeBron James tries to will the Cavaliers to a road win in Oakland against the Monstars. It sometimes feels like Durant, Curry, and Draymond, they're the Monstars from Space Jam, aren't they? And that would make LeBron, Jordan, and Kevin Love, Wayne Knight. There you go. The Warriors have a 3-1 lead, and this has all the makings of a clincher and all the makings of a storybook season for Bron, who, with a win, could put some pressure on the old Warriors. Take it back to Cleveland. If LeBron loses tonight, he'll never be as good as Jordan. So go ahead. Have a good game. No pressure. Also, 20 years ago, this past weekend, 20 years ago, since the flu game, which I read was bad pizza. It wasn't flu. A lot of the Bulls and the history is that it was a bad pizza from a Utah delivery place. And five delivery drivers showed up to deliver the pizza. They knew right away that something was wrong, and the only one who ate it was Michael Jordan. Isn't that interesting? I think it's interesting. Anyway, it's also been 25 years since the Bulls beat the Blazers. Always nice to celebrate anniversaries while other teams are playing for current championships. Always good, right? Okay. Okay, and finally tonight, a new study says that women and people in the South are more likely to have bumper stickers on their car. Huh. So gas, ass, and grass, nobody rides for free. We know that one. Or the Calvin and Hobbes peeing on stuff. We know that one. Or the Gore Lieberman 2000 bumper sticker. That's all women and people from the South? If by people from the South you mean every other dude with a truck, yeah, then I guess that study works. That's the carryout for June 12, 2017. Hey, we got a ton of tchotchkes left over from Spring Awakening this weekend. So if for every order of fries, you get a free neon necklace on us. Never let the music die. All right, coming up, Touche. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy back in studio to argue over everything. We got a lot to argue about tonight. It's coming up here on The Download, 720 WGN. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
I was tempted to turn the microphones down about 10, 15 seconds ago because the argument's already started in studio between Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy. Back together again.
Dave is back.
We're here.
To argue about everything. We got a lot to argue about tonight. Touche, our regular segment on Monday nights.
Justin, I just want to tell you how blessed I am to be here, how much I thank you for the privilege of the blessings being with you here and for you giving a forum to Chris and I to share in these blessings. I thank you for
Chris, would you like to bless it?
I want
to
say, Dave, apart from Marge Halperin, you're really the best Democrat ever to go on with, and I really appreciate the fact that you take all of my statements, and Justin, I just can't say enough about
all right. Vindicate, why don't we have not had a chance to talk.
Should we tell people what that was about?
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm running the Department of Housing and Urban Development.
This was the cabinet meeting that happened today that everyone was a little bit...
Sounds kind of goofy.
Goofy, because they spent most of the time just...
Banana Republican to me, you know.
Giving Trump accolades. All right, let's start with Comey, and then we'll move on from that quick. But vindicated or open up a can of worms for future investigations?
I think that Comey achieved his objectives, but I don't think... I think he's a truthful guy, largely, generally speaking. And I don't really think he laid a hand on Trump.
And thank you for changing your tune, because you had previously said you thought he was vindicated, like Donald Trump said you thought that Trump was vindicated.
Well, Trump was vindicated.
Thank you, because I needed that setup to point out that only in this administration can somebody who's being called a liar multiple times by the former FBI director.
No. By the guy he fired. Such big news. The firee says the firer.
Wait,
is
a moment
liar.
Ago you just said. A moment ago you just said. I don't believe. I believe Comey tells the truth.
It's
so
utterly no.
The
no,
truthful
just,
Comey said Trump is a liar. And you consider that vindication, and Trump considers that vindication.
Generally speaking.
And oh, by the way, even as he was in his press conference on Friday, or his short mini press conference on Friday, even then when he said, "Oh, I never said that about Flynn," he was contradicted the next day by his son, who went on Fox and said, "Well, my dad, if he really wanted him gone, he would have said, or he wanted the investigation over, he would have said that. All he asked, all he told Comey was, you know, I hope you could find," and like, yes,
Chris,
that's
do you
exactly
buy,
what
do,
Comey
do you
said.
Buy the Republican leadership and outside of Trump talking about, oh, Trump just doesn't know any better. He doesn't know politics.
No, I don't. Look, I think that Trump... The fact that he doesn't know any better is no defense, and that's nothing to be raised at this moment. However, we're inside the conundrum, and the bigger and more important point is, if under our Constitution, he has the authority, as he does, to direct Comey to end the investigation, okay, if not for a corrupt purpose, then the greater, that's the greater, it includes the lesser. And the lesser here is, hey, Flynn is a good guy. He gave a lot of service to the country. And I hope you can see your way to getting him out of this thing.
Dave?
I think that we're in a situation where Comey gave some very damning testimony about the president. The Republicans are freaking out about it, which is why suddenly you're seeing the call for firing Bob Mueller.
No. The Mueller thing doesn't have anything to do with Comey testimony. It has to do with him bringing on assistants who have been cited for withholding evidence from defendants when they were prosecutors, or in the case of Dreeben, the other guy. He is a guy who went to the United States Supreme Court and argued an interpretation of obstruction of justice.
Well, why not do that?
That
not?
Was the hear me out.
What anybody
he
has
brought
said.
It. He broadened the definition of obstruction of justice so that a car driving down the street is obstructing justice. He kind of applied a butterfly.
But my point is, why not argue that point as opposed to have the rumors that they want to remove Mueller
if Mueller, well, then this all is the poison tree from which this fruit grows is the personal long-time, career-long relationship and associateship between Mueller and Comey. And with Comey's statements in front of Congress, he became a possible target of this investigation. So you cannot have Mueller investigating a potential target.
You're just making stuff up.
No.
You're just making stuff up. Comey is not a potential target.
He's a potential target of this.
How is he a potential target?
If his leaking was illegal, then he
but
might become a target.
Illegal, and there's nobody.
Well, who are you? What judge?
There is nobody
what
bench
who says, do you sit on?
Chris, last night you and I were on Beyond the Beltway with a former federal prosecutor who said to you, "There's no way that what he did was illegal."
That was his opinion. There are a lot of other opinions, and the opinions that matter are those of judges.
You are
of competent
creatively trying to get rid of the guy who has the
Donald Trump into
real serious jeopardy.
I'm telling the listeners of this August radio station. And Justin, I don't know if we've told you how good you really
it's
are.
It's a blessing.
It's a blessing.
It's a blessing.
I feel blessed to be here. In fact, I might make a visit on my way out. Anyway, I do want to say that Mueller's too close to Comey, and Comey manipulated official records to bring about the appointment of Mueller. And this makes Mueller part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Do you feel like he manipulated to get a special prosecutor?
Well, he didn't manipulate official records. Again, Chris is making
when he
things
is
up.
The FBI director and he's keeping records, those are official records.
Excuse me, that is not a manipulation. Contemporaneous recollection and contemporaneous notes was because he felt that Donald Trump was highly likely, given his history, to lie about their interaction. Wow, where would he come up with that idea?
Well, the fact is...
That is not a manipulation.
The manipulation was giving it to his law professor friend for the purpose of, quote, putting it into the public square.
Right. Whistleblower. Right. Nothing right. Illegal.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, they're trying to eat each other's space. I love it.
Yes, right, but we're doing it while being blessed.
Yeah, you're blessed. All right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll come back and we'll argue this point. is Donald Trump the most productive president of all time in his first 100 days? Chris says ding, ding, ding. And Dave says, we heard that. So, of course, and we will.
Was my mic on for that?
Yeah, your mic was on for that. And we will continue the conversation here on Touche on the download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
You go right, you go right.
All right, it's Touche here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman.
You got to get those guys on a segment sometime when they're coming through town.
Stiller and
Blunt. In their inevitable rematching, you know.
Maybe they would join us for a political
rematch. I think they'd help.
But they'd love it.
They'd probably think I'm a total idiot and
no,
Dave's great.
No way. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy. Why don't we start with you, Chris?
Smart men.
Let me start with you on this one.
Go ahead.
The president today in his cabinet meeting where everyone praised him, talked about he being the most productive president, maybe outside of FDR, although he couched that by saying, well, it was a different time. But he said he's the most productive president first 100 days. Do you agree?
Well, he is more productive on the judicial side and on the executive order side. And I think that he is not necessarily close on the legislative side. And the reason I say that is A,
he hasn't passed anything.
Roosevelt, and B, Reagan. So what he has passed has been minor or really kind of just tentative baby steps. Whereas, you know, Reagan by this time had passed all of his budget reconciliation. That was passed on, I believe, the 13th of May, 1981. Mm. So we were on the 13th of June almost. So he's not at Reagan's pace.
Well, there's a lot of breakdowns today about the numbers, and you can swing it. It seems very political speak, once again, out of Washington, where if you look at one set of numbers, that could be true. If you look at another, that could be false. Where are we in reality and how America views or what the taxpayers view what Donald Trump has accomplished in his first 100 days?
Well, I think that there are a number of ways to slice this. One, has he passed his major legislation? And the answer is no. He got the American Health Care Act through the House on its second try. It now has an approval rating, I think, around 15%. It's now before the
higher
Senate.
Higher than Obamacare.
No, actually, Obamacare is about 55.
No, I mean when Obamacare was running.
Yes. Anyway, so now they're trying to ramrod it through the Senate, and they've said we're not going to let you see the bill until it's final and until it's been fully scored, et cetera, because they don't want anybody to look at what's in this bill. They don't want anybody to have time to analyze it. But I think there's another way to look at it, which is, you know, he fired all those U.S. attorneys, hasn't appointed a single one to replace them. He fired all those ambassadors. He's appointed very few. Much of the government is unstaffed. He has out of 560 Senate confirmable positions, he's filled 20% of them. Hmm. And we're now 5 months into the administration.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I've called on, you know, I think that Reince Priebus is in way over his head. He's doing a terrible job. We see that every day. That's not to say that Trump doesn't himself bear an enormous responsibility for the problems he's created for himself. But Reince Priebus has failed to get the personnel operation under control. And that is a betrayal of all of Trump's voters. Right. And it is just unconscionable right now that the PAS, that's presidential appointee, Senate confirmed positions, are not all at least pending at the Senate. They should all be pending at the Senate. Many of them should already
be. Is that traditionally, when you say it comes from the chief of staff, I mean, is that traditionally the job of a chief of staff or a White House?
Yeah, I mean, the chief of staff is, I mean, certainly it all starts with the president, but the chief of staff has got to kick people in the rear end to keep things moving. And it's way too late for us to say there were folks on the Trump team who were surprised that Trump won. I mean, we're 7 months into this thing. Where is the government? Where are the ambassadors? he is moving along on judicial appointments pretty well. That's because he established a mechanism with Leonard Leo and McCann and the Justice Department.
Let me, in a positive way for Donald Trump, I mean, he got a Supreme Court nominee through.
Yeah. By executing the nuclear option and destroying tradition of the United States Senate of 200 years.
Led by the Democrats.
You mentioned the health care. He did get it through the House, and it looks like he's got a chance to get it through the Senate. He did put a travel ban.
That would put 23 million people off health care.
He did put a travel ban.
And by the way,
place.
That wasn't 200 years. That was you're absolutely wrong about that. 200 years of
I'm sorry. He only busted 100 years of tradition.
There's not a lot, even suggesting tax reform.
Right.
I mean, there is. There you can say that the president
has started.
No.
Getting he may not get him done, but he's getting.
You can't get tax reform because all he did is put out a one pager. Yeah. There's no legislation.
So he started a lot of stuff, but he hasn't finished.
There's no infrastructure. Do you know what last week was? Last week was Infrastructure Week. How many events actually happened in support of Infrastructure Week? I don't know what the infrastructure bill looks like. He should have done that 2 months ago. Challenge the Democrats.
Absolutely. And look, Paul, I like to beat up on Paul Ryan because I am convinced that Paul Ryan is derelict in his duty. And Paul Ryan woke up the day after this election in November and said, I did not like Trump, but he carried my district, my first congressional district of Wisconsin, and he carried my state of Wisconsin. And that hasn't happened with the Republican in many elections. Mm-hmm. And where was he in terms of saying, now it's on me as Speaker of the House to get this program. I'm going to get all of the committee chairmen on a conference call at 10 o'clock this morning and tell them we are going to be ready. It's time for Republican reform. I am furious about this.
Well, I mean, I guess, Dave, I ask you as the Democrat on this panel. I mean, for all the things that he started, is it unreasonable for us to think that all those things would be finished?
It's not that all those things would be finished, but you need to show more progress. And you've shown so little progress on any of the major fronts other than healthcare. And the progress that they have shown is just epically, historically bad. I mean, it's astonishing that they're championing a bill that would likely throw, according to the Congressional Budget Office, somewhere between 23 million people out of healthcare. And by the way, they talk about how, it's going to save $100 billion in the deficit over 10 years. Yeah, but in your first 5 years, premiums are going to go up. That's what CBO said.
And we don't
said.
Know. We don't know if
CBO has been wrong about everything. It's not a terrible bill.
No, it has not
we
been
can
wrong
have another
about
conversation
everything.
About that.
It has not been wrong
I
about everything.
I want to say this. No matter what he had done, David would say it was bad.
Yes, but he's given me so much to work with.
Well, yeah. Okay, but I want to say these guys, what you've got here are congressional Republicans failing to promote their own majority. And here is what I mean. The reason the Democrats have spun this whole cloth idea about Russia and Russian collusion, et cetera, and now they're on. Trump's involvement with Russia held no water ever. So then they switched to collusion, which now holds no water. And now they're talking about the ex post facto. But the point of all that is two things. A, delay the Trump program, and then B, take the House, and then C, impeach Trump. Whence they take the house.
And the only problem I have with this is that you're suggesting that the media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, are arms of a Democratic
Party.
I'm not
suggesting. I'm stating it.
I believe that
the Democratic Party is an arm of the New York Times
and the
media.
My point being that the media is the one looking in. I feel like, if anything, the Democrats have been pretty meek and not been strong on pointing to the problem with Russia. So
I think you're alone in that view. Democrats have been on every TV show, on every radio show. They've been screaming to high heaven. I've been sitting next to David as he has screamed to high heaven.
But
it is the only thing they've got, since they cannot deal with the fact
no,
that
actually,
Hillary lost.
I'd love to talk about the policy, because the policy is so god-awful. Let's talk about health care. Let's expose health care. Let's expose the fact that last Thursday, on the day that Comey was testifying, Republicans in the House took the opportunity to repeal Dodd-Frank.
If only they had repealed Dodd-Frank. They didn't go far enough in repealing
Okay, they
Dodd-Frank.
Repealed much of Dodd-Frank.
And you
under
know what?
Cover of Comey.
And you, who is supposed cares about neighborhoods and small towns, under Dodd-Frank, the community banking sector of the United States has gone from threatened to extinction. Okay, it is on the Endangered Species Act at the EPA, and that's because of Dodd-Frank's Very
we've just mixed like 27 different things.
And I
endangered
you
species
know what?
Is not EPA.
Yeah, EPA has a lot to do with endangered species, let me tell you. I live that. But be that as it may.
It's Department of the Interior.
We need commercial banks operating at a community level. They've been wiped out by Dodd-Frank.
Now, no doubt that they're, that you'll listen
to And Democrats to the... don't care because they get so much money from wealthy Wall Street people.
Oh, thank you. I feel so much better now. Rather get money from wealthy Wall Street people than Russian oligarchs. In any event, look, I'm talking about the Russia stuff.
I have not received a dime.
I'm talking about the Russia stuff because the president has been in denial about the Russian interference in the election and has repeatedly tweeted that the whole thing is a hoax.
Yeah.
So, and it would
so
be helpful.
Right.
It would be helpful if, and you guys just keep giving us this stuff because every time an issue comes up about the Trump relationships with Russia and the Trump associate relationship with Russia, Trump's people lie and then get caught.
That's going to have to be the last word. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling back at it with Touche. They'll be back next Monday. Guys, thanks for being here.
See ya.
Pete, we just had a texter say, all I ever hear WGN radio talk about is Trump, Trump, Trump 24/7. I'm like, well, maybe 18-7. Because coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, we're not talking. If you're listening to Download every night, we will spend time on national politics and we move on. We try to be as respectful, give equal time to both sides. And we are going to move on from Trump and talk about infinity. More importantly, math phobia. Dr. Eugenia Chang is here. I'm very excited to talk with her. She is a wonderful, wonderful sort of proponent of math. And mathematics, and we're going to talk with her coming up here at the big table, 8 o'clock. All right. Thanks, Rob. It's a Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the show, we're going to talk with W. Kamau Bell, the host of CNN's United Shades of America. He is going to be at the Park West coming up on Friday night. So we'll talk with him. Also, Ellen King's going to be here from Hune. It's an artisanal bread shop in Evanston. We're going to talk about bringing back the grain economy to the Midwest. This is a really interesting topic about trying to revitalize that industry and engage farmers to think more about organic grains and think about the bread that's coming into the area. So we'll talk with Ellen coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then Studio 435 tonight, the Dream Pop sounds. Dream Pop, I'll take it. All right, Panda Riot in studio. So my next guest is trying to rid the world of math phobia. It's true, human beings seem to be intimidated, if not fully freaked out, by numbers and the high-end world of mathematics. Count me in that bunch. But Dr. Eugenia Chang has spent her life trying to debunk the degree of difficulty and explain math in ways we can all appreciate. Whether it's her New York Times best-selling book, How to Bake Pie, sure, an edible exploration of the mathematics of mathematics, or her lectures across the globe, including her YouTube videos, Chang continues to make it her life's mission to rid us of our primal fear. You like that? You like no, didn't work?
Very good.
Pete
very
liked it.
Funny.
Pete liked it in there.
Woo-hoo.
Dr. Eugenia Chang is a scientist and resident at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and her new book is called Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. Dr. Eugenia Chang in studio tonight. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And this is one of those issues I said at the top, and I was kind of joking with Ro at the crossover, which is just that math is not my thing. So one area I just can't do it, but I'm fully intrigued, and I'm committed and curious about this topic tonight.
Well, that's the main thing, to remain curious. What makes me sad is when some people say that it's not their thing and that they stop being curious and that they're afraid of it and they don't want to know anymore. So as long as you're curious, then there's plenty we can do about it.
All right, so let's talk. Why don't we talk about the new book? Let's talk infinity. What I know about infinity and the concept is that's the number to trump all numbers. You really, if you want to put someone in their place, you say infinity. And
now, why would you want to put someone in their place? That's not very nice,
not very
is
nice.
It?
But talk about the concept of infinity. What is infinity?
That's a great question. That's right why I wrote a whole book about it. And because even small children can get really fascinated by the concept of this huge thing. And yet it's really difficult to understand. So you can think of it when you're, 3 or 4 or 5 years old. But mathematicians spent thousands of years trying to understand it because it's actually not as simple as all that. You might think it's the number to trump all numbers, But one of the things I talk about in my book is that there's actually bigger and bigger infinities, and the infinities keep getting bigger and
smaller and smaller too.
And smaller and smaller ones. So you actually can't, if you're trying to put someone in their place, then first of all, that's not very nice. And secondly, you kind of can't, because they can put you right back in your place, and it will go on like that forever.
Well, I mean, the idea of it, I mean, it's such an interesting concept, infinity, and it really is based on the concept of loops. This idea that it just goes around and around and around.
That is definitely one of my favorite ways that I first thought about and encountered infinity. I tell this story in my book. I grew up in a house that had a chimney in the middle, and all the rooms went around the chimney in a big circle. The idea was that the chimney in the middle would heat the whole house up. But the real point was that it meant that my sister and I could chase each other round and round in circles. And that is so much more fun than chasing around a room just kind of backwards and forwards, or round and round a chair or something. We had a real loop, and it felt like we had an infinite house. And I think that is so cool that inside our little house, we could have an infinite place to chase each other around. Of course, it was always very funny to turn around spontaneously and chase each other backwards and have hysterics. But to me, that was a first inkling that infinity fits even inside our finite world, which is a very weird concept. And I love weird concepts.
Well, I guess I get that, the concept, and this is where I'm hunkering down in here. But the concept of loops and infinity and running around, like you say in the book about running around the chimney, that to me, I get that concept. But expanding that out to talk about the wonderful world of endless numbers and where it stops or where it doesn't stop, mm-hmm. that's where I feel like I'm with the rest of the world and say, all right, you lost me. But talk about how numbers, there is no end. It continues. And I think that's the part of the book that really kind of grabbed me, this idea that it just never kind of stops.
Yeah. And the numbers go on forever. That's the first inkling we have in infinity. What is the biggest number? Well, there isn't a biggest number, because if there were a biggest number, then we could always add one. And that would make a bigger number, or would it? So you might say, well, infinity plus one is infinity.
Right, right.
But is it? And one of the things that I talk about is that when mathematicians finally pin down the idea of infinity, they realize that there are different kinds of infinity. And there's one kind where one plus infinity is not the same as infinity plus one. And I like to think this is like what Shakespeare said in The Taming of the Shrew when he talked about forever and a day, because clearly he thought forever and a day was longer than forever. Let's just think about forever and a day. You have to wait through the entire of forever and then another day. That's got to be longer than forever. I'm with Shakespeare on that one.
Well, I mean, at a certain point, you talked about thousands of years of people studying these numbers. At a certain point, do you start to recognize that the concept of infinity as we know it, it follows the same logic that numbers do, whole numbers, the idea
it kind of does and it doesn't. And that's the thing you have to be careful about. If you're not careful about it and you think that infinity behaves just like a number, then you very quickly get to deduce that 1 = 0. And that's not so great. But it's okay.
Right.
You're just in the zero world, and the zero world is a thing. It's just not a very, you can't do very much in the zero world. But the fact that numbers don't behave quite like infinity is a first clue that we have to be careful about our gut instincts. And one of the things that I like to say math is, it's about figuring out how to make sense of the things that we think we feel.
Yeah.
And goodness knows it helps if people make sense of it rather than just keeping on going.
Because I think about math and generally it's about, and at its base level, it's about logic, but it's also about counting. The idea that we're always there's this sort of ladder of numbers that go up.
Mm-hmm.
And so infinity would be the idea of it, the top of that. Like the logic tells me that you keep going and mm-hmm. keep going and keep going and it never stops.
Uh-huh.
So in your book, talking about how there are different ways that's not necessarily how it works, and that there are different ways infinity is calculated, is where it blows my mind.
Well, you have to start thinking about what numbers are really. And it's one of those things where you start thinking about it and then you realize you don't understand anything. And at that point, I think the world divides into two types of people. People go, oh, come on, we all know what numbers are. This is pointless. I'm going to go and eat my dinner. And people go, oh, this is really cool. And I love optical illusions, where you stare at something, you know, those things like there's a picture and there's suddenly some gray dots appear when you wiggle your head or something like that. And to me, that aspect of infinity is the intellectual version of an optical illusion, where something weird is going on and I love it and I want to understand why.
It almost is a mystery.
It is a mystery. And I love the fact that there are lots of different ways of explaining it. So a lot of people think that math is just about finding the right answer. But I think it's much more interesting than that. It's about figuring out what answers are possible, depending on what kind of world you decide you're in.
Where were you when I was in high school? Like, I just feel like when we were doing geometry and it was a certain theory and you applied it to a certain thing, I'm like, that's okay. There, that's the answer.
That's it.
And they're like, well, it could be any answer. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense to me. I'm going to go somewhere else. The book is called Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. In studio, Dr. Eugenia Cheng. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about math phobia. Sound good?
Sounds great.
It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Dr. Eugenia Cheng. She is the scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And she's got a new book out called Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. She also had the New York Times best-selling book, How to Bake Pi, P-I, of course, the symbol, number. We're talking about mathematics, which is your life. And I mentioned at the top this idea of math phobia. And it is a real thing. I mean, I think that more, I mean, I would think that people even listening to us sort of, you know, battle over the idea of what it means to find infinity. People are like, I'm out. Right. Talk about math phobia. Is it a real thing?
Yeah, it is a real thing. And it's been studied by psychology researchers and educationalists. And I fully sympathize with anyone who has math phobia. It's not your fault. This is the beginning of the therapy session. It's not your fault. Everything is against you. I think that the education system is unfortunately placed. I think many people develop the phobia in elementary school, but also it gets passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And I understand that because I have a fear of dogs and it was passed on to me by my mother. She has a fear of dogs and that you pick up on those things, and that's natural. I think that as children we're supposed to be afraid of the things our parents are afraid of. That's how we learn about the world. So it's okay if you have math phobia. I think that many people get it, and this is one of the things I love about teaching art students at the School of the Art Institute. Many of them have math phobia, but they're very curious because they're really serious art students, so they're very curious about the world. And so we talk about math phobia, and many of them say that they got it. They loved math maybe when they were five in kindergarten, when it's all about playing with shapes and blocks. And then they got the phobia at that point where they started getting things wrong. And they're told they're wrong, and they didn't understand why they were wrong. So it just becomes a kind of scary place where there are strange rules.
Frustrating, yeah.
You don't know when you're going to break one. Someone tells you you're wrong. So of course you would rather go off into a subject where there is no right and wrong, where you write a story and someone says, oh, that's a lovely story. And like, your story is wrong. Your picture is wrong.
There's something to be said about that. I mean, the idea that we think of our multiplication tables or division, and you're right, there's an X, or it's either right or wrong. I mean, this is an area, and when you think about just in elementary schools alone, where it's one of the only types of studies that is like that.
Right. And the thing that's really a shame about it is that when you get to high level math, it's not like that at all. So we're somehow putting everyone off with something that isn't even actually math, because I like to say it would be like having art class where all you do is paint by numbers. And if you don't put the right paint in the right number, then you're wrong. That would be the same kind of thing. And then a whole load of people might grow up thinking, oh, I don't like art. It's not creative. Yeah. It's all about right and wrong. And without realizing that art isn't like that at all, that when you do art, you interpret things and you make your own things up. And it's the same with math, that when you get to a higher level, it's about figuring out what things are possible. It's about possibility, which is the opposite of right and wrong, which is kind of about impossibility.
I mean, you've said this, that math is constructing arguments that hold up under logic. And what does that mean? I mean, the concept of your, when you say constructing arguments, it kind of flies in the face of what I think of math, because like you just said, math is a rigid sort of, here are the numbers and these numbers add up to mean something, and you subtract those numbers and that's the answer. And if it's not the answer that I thought, you made a mistake and that's the wrong answer.
There is a part of math that is doing calculations to find answers. But most of math, in my opinion, is more about spotting patterns and building up structures and understanding why things work. So you use logic, which means you're supposed to be able to deduce what things are true by just inherent features about them. So not because of coincidences and not because of feelings and emotions and not because someone had more money than someone else and not because someone was bigger and they beat them up. But none of those things, just through inherent characteristics of things, the way that things are related to each other. So it really gets to the heart of how things work. Now, the trouble is that most things don't work logically. I mean, I don't really work logically. I'm sure you don't work logically. The computer, you know, the air conditioning system doesn't work logically. So we have to do something which is called abstraction, where we forget all the pesky details that prevent things from behaving logically. And that takes us away from the world of objects into the world of ideas. And that move can be one of the things that makes people get the fear, because suddenly you don't feel like you have your feet on the ground.
Right, right.
And a lot of people say to me, oh, I was fine with math until all the numbers became letters. Why did they do that? Oh, I don't like that. And that is an abstraction where the letters are things that could now represent any number. And the thing is, it's really there out of laziness. Mathematicians are really lazy. We don't want to do the same thing over and over again. So when you do an abstraction, you say, I'm going to do an X instead of doing each number separately. And that means I've done all the numbers at once.
Right.
And so really, it's about conservation of brain power. And I think our brains are so precious. It's really important to conserve our brain power and not do things over and over again when we can make a theory that we'll do it once. I think we're like the intellectual versions of people who build gadgets, kind of crazy gadgets.
That's
like,
so interesting.
I don't want to have to cut the top of my boiled egg every day. I'm going to make a gadget. That kind of thing.
Well, and it makes a lot of sense. And I mean, obviously, if I was told this when I was a freshman in high school or seventh grade, I'd be like, it doesn't make sense. But as an old, you know, 42-year-old, I'm like, it does make sense. The idea that the abstract of putting a letter in place of the number is to say this could be any number. It's all numbers. It's the concept that this is the formula that's going to get us to answering this question. The numbers really don't matter.
And the thing is that numbers are already an abstraction. So it's just that we all did that abstraction so long ago that we've kind of forgotten about it and we take it for granted. But I think it shows that we're all capable of it. And language is already an abstraction. If I say cat, I know we all know that that's referring to some animal that's fluffy with a tail and stuff. But the word cat is an abstract thing that relates to the physical object, which is a cat. And children have to learn how to associate those abstract things with objects. And they also have to learn how to count. And learning how to count doesn't just mean reciting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's a story I tell in my first book where there was this great mother who also helped at the primary school, the elementary school I was helping with. And she said, all these other mothers, they say their children can count to 20. She said, my son can count to 3, but he knows what 3 is. And I love that. Because it's actually
great.
Quite profound.
Yeah, it is profound.
Knowing
yeah.
that the concept of 3 refers to 3 objects, and it could be any 3 objects. It could be 3 apples, it could be 3 cookies, it could be 3 monkeys. So when you make the leap from 3 objects to 3, you've done something great. Everyone should pat themselves on the back for being able to make that leap of abstraction right there.
Well, a lot of math as we know it. I mean, I think of this because I think I struggle with, I have a 9-year-old son and we start to get into it. But I think a lot of it's about leaps.
Mm-hmm.
There's this you have to trust yourself to go in a certain direction with the problem. Mm-hmm. If it's a word problem or a multiplication, whatever it is, you're trusting yourself to make the leap to go with the or towards the logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to me is exciting, but I can understand the fear. I can understand the idea that I'm going to leap.
You might kind of fall off.
And you might fall.
Yeah. And I think that the other thing is that it to understand math, it sort of involves being confused a lot of the time. And you sort of have to be okay with that.
You have to be okay with that, right.
That I'm fine with being confused. I feel like I'm basically confused all the time in life, so it's fine. But I think that if people get the idea that being confused is somehow bad and that they want to know everything definitively, that's funny, because I think they think that in math you're supposed to know everything definitively. And that's not the case at all. It's a great place to be confused. And I just think every time you're confused, it's an opportunity to become more intelligent.
If you're positive about that confusion, if you let the confusion dip into insecurities or to anxiety, the idea that, you know, I shouldn't be definitive about this, then I can see why that's trouble. But you're right. If you let confusion come and you see it as an opportunity to be curious or positive, then yeah, that, right. that's a great learning
and
opportunity.
And you're absolutely right about insecurity, because I see a lot of students who kind of freak out because they get to university level math and suddenly it's not as easy as high school math, and they think that they're really bad at it suddenly because they're feeling way more confused than they ever did in
high school. They want to be prepared, because they feel like, I understand that, the idea that they want high school was to prepare them for college. Mm-hmm. They don't want to go in and be like, I learned everything in my right hand and now you want me to write left hand.
Right, but in a way, it's often the people who feel fine about math are not necessarily the ones who are better. They're just the ones who don't even realize how confused they are.
The book is Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. We're talking with Dr. Eugenia Chang. She's the author. She's also the best-selling author of How to Bake Pie, An Edible Exploration of the Mathematics of Mathematics. She's dedicated her life to math phobia and talking about mathematics and, of course, teaching it. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a break for tonight's news, and we'll continue the conversation at the big table right after that. Stay with us. Drop. It is a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later, W. Kamau Bell will be here, the host of CNN's United Shades of America, stand-up comedian who has come to the Park West on Friday. So we'll be coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. But right now, we continue our conversation here at the big table with Dr. Eugenia Chang. She is the author of Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. She's also the best-selling author of How to Bake Pie, P-I, the symbol, An Edible Exploration of the Mathematics of Mathematics. We are talking about math phobia. We are talking about how to better understand an area something that a lot of people, when they've run into trouble mm-hmm. with math, they give up on it.
Yeah.
Or they just say, you know what, this is not for me. And I think everybody understands, including myself, and I'm right in this category, that yes, it's the building blocks of engineering and how everything comes together. You use mm-hmm. math to make this wondrous world that we live in. But somebody else can do that. Somebody.
Right. Right. So everyone kind of knows that math is important to engineering and science. Right. And then you can just go, oh, well, I'm not going to be an engineer or a scientist, so I don't need to know any of that stuff. Right.
Right.
I mean, kind of, in the sense that, yeah, you probably don't need to solve equations or be able to do calculus or be able to do things like prove things in geometry, though, or do trigonometry or all that stuff that they make you do
at
school.
Don't get me started, yeah.
And yet, math is important beyond those things, because it's not just about solving specific problems in life. It's about thinking clearly. And doesn't everyone want to be able to think more clearly? I think that math and logical thinking should be at the core of all the thinking that we do, which is like going to the gym and doing exercises that strengthen your physical core. It's not that anything we do in life just uses our core,
right.
But having a strong physical core means that we have better access to the rest of our muscles in our body.
Suggesting I get my old Algebra 2 book out and I do the problems in there to be a better critical thinker?
I am not suggesting that, because I don't actually think that the kind of math in the usual curriculum is quite right. And that's one of the reasons that I started writing books, because I wanted to show the kind of math that I think is relevant. And to make good on this belief, that I started teaching it to art students at the School of the Art Institute. Now, these are art students. They are not going to be engineers or scientists. I'm not trying to turn them into research mathematicians. So this is really for people who are interested in thinking about the world. And mm-hmm. okay, so some people aren't interested in thinking about the world. Fine, then maybe you don't need to be able to think more clearly. But math is about using your brain in a particular way. And there are so many different ways to use our brain. Math is just one of them, but I think it's a really central one, because math is, in fact, everywhere. There is math in everything. And you might say that you can get by, people say to me, I get by perfectly fine without math, it's all right. And I say, yeah, but I get by better.
There's a charm in that, of course. I guess I see that. And what you've been talking about in this hour is just about giving us a better understanding of what math is. This idea of logic, or trying to get to logic, and trying to argue and think critically about the concepts that are in front of us. It's not just about pulling out the calculator and mm-hmm. seeing what the multiplications are. Mm-hmm. Is that a different thread or a different area than what we learn in schools? Is schools a different kind of math?
I think that what we learn in school is trying to train people in how to think clearly, but it's failing dismally, dare I say it. There are some fantastic math teachers who are doing a really great job of getting people excited. But unfortunately, there's all this pressure on teachers to get students through standardized tests. And that pressure to hit those targets on standardized tests means that everyone ends up sort of feeling a pressure to teach to the test. And it's not the teacher's fault at all. It's really the system. And it takes more creativity and a bit more resources and a bit more trust in teachers to teach students how to think and not just how to produce answers to predetermined questions.
I feel like that is how I knew math. Mm-hmm. I knew math by trying to get to a predetermined mm-hmm. answer, and I needed to figure out the formula to get there. And when I was done, oh, good, mm-hmm. I could go to reading. I could
go
somewhere
but
else.
But it really is possible to encourage and train people to think logically without just saying, okay, do this problem set, solve this problem that you're not interested in the slightest, solve this problem about triangles. Who cares about triangles? You know, I mean, actually, I find triangles quite interesting. But if you don't care about triangles, then you're never going to care about all those things with triangles. But, for example, this weekend, I did an event with Math Circles of Chicago, and they're a fantastic organization that aims to bring more interesting math, especially to children who don't have access necessarily to all the resources that other schools have. And they did a thing called the Julia Robinson Math Festival, which is where we just went into, it was at Walter Payne College, and we just set up tables with activities. And nothing had a particular aim. It was just kind of exploring some math. So I did one where we just got a bunch of shapes out of card. We had tons of card and tape and scissors, and everyone was just invited to cut shapes out and stick them together. And children of all ages, from 3 to adults, just got really excited about seeing what you can build using shapes. And
there
was no wrong answer. And one parent came up to me and said, what's the aim here? What are we supposed to do? I'm like, you can do anything you want.
Well, I mean, I think that there, as you mentioned, I mean, the curriculum side of standardized testing, I think that also goes a little bit to parents mm-hmm. in the way that we look at our kids and we say, you're not understanding that, then you're gonna have a tough time in school if you don't understand this base problem. You don't understand how to do this multiplication or division.
And it's true that the math curriculum, unfortunately, is built up cumulatively, so that if you don't understand the thing before it, you're kind of doomed to not understand the thing after it. And that's another reason people get really put off. And yet, I've taught high-level abstract math to art students, some of whom cannot do multiplication. They certainly can't do division. And yet I show them things that you usually do when you're doing a PhD in abstract math. And so we're kind of making people jump through hoops in order to get to do something that has nothing to do with jumping through hoops.
Where does this enthusiasm come from, Dr. Chang? I mean, for you, you've dedicated your life to teaching art students or teaching people who may not know much about math or mm-hmm. or going after the idea of the dreaded math phobia. Mm-hmm. Where does this come from? I mean, why not just be a research mathematician and hang out with mathematicians and say, we are the smartest people in the world? And
I'm glad you asked that, because I have had a slightly unusual career. I was a tenured math professor in the UK, and I quit that, which is quite unusual, because I wanted to dedicate my life to reaching more people. And I strongly believe that if you have some skills, it's really important to use them to the best possible ability to help the world in the way that you can. And yeah, I could have carried on doing research, and I still do research, but I think that there aren't that many research mathematicians who are capable of explaining it to
are going to go to YouTube
who care about it or who enjoy it. And because I enjoy doing it, I care about it, and people say that I am good at it or that I'm able to explain things to them, I felt like it was more important for the world for me to do that, that was a more important contribution than just carrying on teaching math majors inside a university. Because I thought, you know what, if I don't teach this calculus class, someone else is going to teach this calculus class. But if I don't go and spread the love of math around the world, who's doing it? There are people doing it, but there aren't enough people doing it. And so I thought it was more important for me to do that than teach calculus again.
Well, I mean, another part of your background in your bio is that you are a musician, mm-hmm. and you hear about music being similar to math in the way that you have to know the notes and there are structures that you can put together, but at the same time, you can be confused and find something new that comes out of it. Mm-hmm. Talk about the relationship between music and being a musician and math.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I'd like to say that it's not just about things like counting. Sometimes people say, oh, yeah, you have to count the beats. And you know, it's not about that, because math isn't about numbers any more than music is just about counting beats. I do love the structures inside music and the harmony and the way it fits together. And I love music that has really interesting harmony underneath it, because that to me is like logical structures that fit together. But I also love it when, like you say, you're confused, when you don't understand why a piece of music, what makes you feel so much. And I love analyzing and trying to understand. Well, I love trying to understand everything. And that's fundamentally why I'm a mathematician. But I love trying to understand why a piece of music makes me cry. And my friends will laugh at me because lots of pieces of music make me cry. But I enjoy the fact that beyond a certain point, you can't explain it anymore.
Yeah,
so you
right.
can explain and explain and explain, and then you run out of explanation. And to me, that point where you run out of explanation is magical, because you've got to the end of the explanation and there's still something else. And I think that's part of what we're talking about, being confused. And in math, it's the same. I love the fact that there are all these things we can explain and then something that we can't. And I sort of enjoy living in that boundary area just in between where you can and can't.
Well, I mean, I automatically would think that math is logic, and I would think it's not emotion, meaning that, the part you're talking about, the tears or crying on a piece of music, that's emotion. That's going to be something that defies logic. That's partially why we have an emotional response to it. Am I wrong in that thought, the thought that math is not emotional, that it's logic?
I think that there's an arbitrary boundary that we're constructing between logic and emotions. And I think that's unhelpful. And it's similar to the arbitrary boundary we construct between science and art, which is also unhelpful. These are artificial boundaries that we put because we're desperately trying to pigeonhole the world into.
We want to make sense of it,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But in fact, logic and emotions go together. And logic is how we kind of test to see whether things are true. But emotion is how we feel that things are true. And those things should go together. We needn't pit them against each other, I think. And at the moment, I've just made some, I got really excited this week because I made some actual progress in my research. Amazing. But I got so excited that my pulse started racing. Honestly, I had to take deep breaths and calm down because I was so excited. I had to jump up and down. I mean, I get that excited when something starts coming together, because you feel like you've been hacking your way through a jungle with a machete or something, or that you're wandering through fog and there's just fog everywhere. And then it's as if the fog starts to clear and a ray of sunshine starts just edging through. The joy of seeing sunshine, like now we've got sunshine after however many months of winter, when that first ray of sunshine comes through, that's how exciting it is to understand something in mathematics. And that's the kind of joy I want to share with people.
Do you feel that joy is that it's shared? Meaning I think of times when I got a good grade in my math because I figured out a program. I don't know if I ever thought of a ray of light. I thought, great, I'm going to get a B.
Because it was the grade, right? It was right, the grade right, that you were after. Where I've done some projects with my art students where we're trying to find structures inside things that you might not think of as exciting at all, like factors of numbers. No one's ever found those interesting until I show them these amazing geometric structures you can find inside factors of numbers. And when they figure it out, they get so excited and you hear actual screams of delight. And or one student said, mind blown. Or they go, oh, my goodness, I can't believe it. I mean, I love being able to get that excitement response from math.
I don't know how much. I mean, I'd love to hear that response figuring out a math problem or discovering something, because that's something I don't necessarily think of when I think of discovering, you know, or getting a math problem.
So
or
those are the things
solution,
I
right.
want to show more people. So when I give public talks, I show some of my favorite math structures and reveal them and try and show, build up the excitement around them. And the thing I'm always aiming for is to get that from the audience collectively. And if I get that, I think I've touched some people and maybe they can start being open to the fact that there's that in math, just like there's that in music and there's that in art and poetry and food. You know, when you eat some food that's so delicious, you practically want to cry. Well, I cry quite easily, but...
Well, I guess it comes to this idea of some sort of archetype or stereotype of people who are into math.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's mathematicians or it's students who are good at math, they're nerdy. And there's this concept of, you know, that you really like numbers, so you're socially awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, I can go on and on about the sort of construct that we've created around people who enjoy math. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that our society sort of does that to people who dig math?
I think it's partly a defense mechanism. So you're not good at something, a bunch of people aren't good at something, so they go, well, it's not cool to be good at that anyway. I'm going to be the cool people. I'm going to be the cool people who hang out, you know, and do something else. You know, those are the sad people who don't have any friends who have to go and do math. And that's another reason why I thought it was important for me to reach a more general public, because I want to buck that trend and show that you don't have to be some weirdo. I mean, okay, maybe you think I'm a weirdo, but I hope that I don't fit all those stereotypes. And to show that you don't have to be socially awkward, you can have friends and be a mathematician, and that you don't have to look like the kinds of weird mathematicians who are usually portrayed by the media.
You do not have tape on your glasses.
It's true, I don't. Quick check. No, I really don't.
I think from this conversation, the one thing I do take away from it, and you know, as someone who falls into the category of having math phobia, is that when faced with confusion in my life, mm-hmm. and I don't it doesn't have to be just about math, it could be about mm-hmm. anything, but when faced with confusion, instead of running away from mm-hmm. it or trying quickly to find clarity, mm-hmm. that I embrace the positivity of that opportunity mm-hmm. to solve a mystery or to solve or to find that clarity.
Yeah, and I really think that math, being a mathematician for me, is a bit like being a black belt karate in brain, because I feel like I can get my brain to do anything, and that I can understand anything. And if I were a black belt in karate, I would feel much safer walking up the street late at night, for example. But as it is, I feel completely safe walking into any intellectual territory, and I feel like I can understand anything, and that includes other people. Actually, it's not usually, people don't usually think of math as being something that helps you understand people, but for me it's because I know how to break everything down extremely logically and find what causes what, even if the person isn't themselves logical necessarily, or we don't think they're logical, there's still some reason that people think the things they do, and I always want to find those reasons. And when there are disagreements in the world, as there unfortunately often are, I think it's so important to find connections with people rather than just push everyone further apart. And for me, being able to think logically means that I can find those connections because I can understand what the root is of what people are thinking.
The book is called Beyond Infinity, An Expedition to the Outer Limits of Mathematics. Dr. Eugenia Cheng is a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute right here in Chicago. And she's also the best-selling author of How to Bake Pie, An Edible Exploration of the Mathematics of Mathematics. Dr. Cheng, thanks so much for being my guest, and thank you for enlightening us in the world of math.
Thank you for your curiosity.
You know, I think about it, and as both a failed math student and trying not to be a failed math parent, I feel like at the end of the day, and that's why I really like that Dr. Cheng was here, I feel like they'll teach in the schools that you need to get good grades
mm-hmm.
and that you need to figure out these problems, you know, to get those good grades. But they never explain what math is.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds heady and over the top, but if I would have gotten a clear understanding, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, freshman, of why this stuff is not why it's important or how I'm going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
That's always how it always, you know, sort of breaks down. It breaks down in some weird way where it's like, oh, well, how am I going to use math in my life? No. What is math? And I want to know more about, I mean, what it's unlocking. You know, this concept of logic and essentially, like she said, logic and emotion, but this idea that what is it? It's this ability to use your brain in a different way. I know, again, sounds heady, but man, I don't know about you at home. You listen wherever you're listening, but I would love to figure out a new way to use my brain. Right? I'm kind of getting sick and tired of using the brain the same way over and over. There's more ways to use your brain. It could change the way I look at things.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they explain that in fourth grade?
Well,
right?
Yeah, it's all, like she said, the pressure on teachers to get standardized test scores is, that's the most important thing.
I feel like, you know, even kind of, it's funny, like even in the lead up, even in the crosstalk, whatever, whenever I met, we're going to talk about math and math phobia. It's snickers and laughs. Mostly me. I'm the first. I've said it throughout the interview. It's just not an area that I feel that comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to find defense mechanisms to make jokes about it, to not have to deal with the fact that it confuses me.
Mm-hmm.
And then to hear Dr. Chang say, that's the point. It's supposed to confuse you. And the concept of math is figuring out how to be clear. The confusion is you're supposed to get to a certain point where you're confused, and then math is figuring out how to get out of it. That's amazing to me. It blows my mind in the way that I'm like, oh, I always thought once I got to confusion, I'm like, I'm doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I think that, you should go up to Truman College, sign up for a math class, start all over.
Now I get Goodwill Hunting. I never knew why it was so great that Matt Damon understood math. No. All right, coming up at 9 o'clock hour, W. Kamau Bell will join us. He's got a show at the Park West coming up at the end of the week. And we will also talk about artisan bread making, the bread shop Hewn, in Evanston. They'll be here, and we'll talk about essentially revitalizing the grain economy and what that means here in the Midwest. So we got a big show, including live music coming up in the 10 o'clock hour with Panda Riot. So we got plenty coming up here. Let's take a break. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Like I've been saying, W. Kamau Bell is going to join us, the host of CNN's United Shades of America. That's coming up after 9:30 tonight. Also, Panda Riot, the dream pop band. Bob Ferguson's right behind me. You can hear him plugging in. He's getting ready. The studio is being transformed as we speak for some dream pop. The Panda Riot will be in studio tonight, which I love. Their new album, Pete, you'll love this. It is called Infinity Maps. Infinity. See, we're just talking infinity with Dr. Chang. There you go. All right, it's Monday night, so it's time for Industry Night, our weekly segment that delves into the world of food and hospitality. Last week, we talked breakfast. This week, we go for the bread. Artisan bread making is on full display at Hewn in Evanston, H-E-W-N. The bakery is the brainchild of Ellen King. She's the head baker and co-owner. And Ellen is not only bringing the ancient art of bread making to the Midwest, but she's helping to revitalize the grain economy here, bringing back heritage grains that haven't grown here for years. It's part food, it's part art, it's part history. Ellen King's my guest on the Download tonight. Ellen, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
All right, so let's talk about this. I love the concept of bread making. What was the concept behind Hewn to bring this kind of experience to Evanston?
Well, I moved here from Seattle, and I had missed eating really rustic bread and that I'd eaten on the West Coast and in Europe. And I also had a young son, and I didn't want to work in restaurants again. And I had finally, for the first time on my hands a little bit, fitting bread making in between naps.
Yeah, right.
And I just kind of became obsessed with making bread and realizing I did not want to work the late hours of a restaurant.
Where's the obsession come from? What was the obsession with making bread?
Well, I think first off, I love eating bread. I love everything about it. Whenever I've traveled in the world, bread is always safe, right? It's like you go in some street food, it's like, I shouldn't eat that. And then you regret it later. Well, bread, you never regret it.
You never regret it.
And, it's just always been a comfort food. And when I came here, I thought that I was in the heartland of grain. This is where it all started kind of in our country. And so much of the history of how grain evolved happened here with the grain mills and grading grain and all of this. But there weren't a lot of wheat being grown for human consumption. Hmm. So it was kind of ironic that most of the wheat was being trucked in from other areas.
That's interesting. So, I mean, from your experience in Seattle, you had this idea of what the Midwest was and the grains and wheat. And when you got here, it's just not being done that way.
Well, I mean, and I grew up here and I left and I'd grown up around farmlands, but I had no clue what I was growing up around, right? It was like corn, soybean. I don't know. I thought it was wheat. Some of it could have been wheat, but it was a totally transformative where I had to realize that it was going to be a lot harder to source local wheat. And then I had my background in history. And so I was always kind of involved in agricultural history, and just was fascinated with like what happened. Where did the wheat go?
Where did it go? I mean, have you been able to track what happened to the grain economy here in Chicago?
Well, a lot of the grain that is grown here, I mean, we grow a lot of corn, a lot of soybeans. We do grow wheat, but it's a lot of conventionally grown wheat. So it's sprayed with a lot of different chemicals and pesticides. And organic wheat has been something that's really not been grown on a large scale here. Mm. But it's really exciting right now because the tide is changing. And one farmer who is really, I call him like the godfather of the organic movement in the Midwest, especially Illinois. His name's Harold Wilkin, and he's got over 2,000 acres of organic grain being grown, and he's getting the first stone mill up and running probably in, 70 years in the state of Illinois.
Wow.
So we're going to soon have access to a ton of local organic grain.
I mean, for you as somebody who is a bread maker, I mean, how important is it for you to be able to locally source your grain and have it be organic? I mean, that's really part and parcel for the business plan of Hewn.
Yeah, I mean, flour is our biggest ingredient, right? So having that and knowing that it's coming from local farms and that it's sustainably raised, it might not be certified organic, but I know the farmers that are growing it, is so important, because what people forget is that wheat actually has a flavor. You oftentimes think, oh, it's just wheat, it's all tastes the same. There's varieties that have different flavors and different characteristics. And so it's really exciting when you're working with these different varieties. Some of them I'm like, I don't like that. And then others, it's like, that's amazing. It tastes like a rye hybrid, and you can really like kind of geek out on your wheat. And then part of it's like, am I imagining this? So we have to like do a reality check with
customers.
Well,
I love it. Geeked out on wheat. I think that there's something there. We might have a spinoff show we could do. But
right.
I mean, talk about this, how important it is for you if you're going to be opening a business where you're going to do artisanal breads and you're going to be making from scratch, how important it is for you to have these relationships with farmers in the area?
Well, it's vital for them in particular, because the grain industry in particular has been one that has been so far removed from consumers' consciousness that connecting who's growing your grain.
Right. I'd never think about that. Right?
Yeah. I mean,
produce is a different story. And, we're even getting to the point with meat now. You're hearing more about, locally with meat production. But the idea of grain, it's not something that's on the top of my
And it's such, it's one of the crops that's the most consumed, right? Wheat is something that is like humans have been consuming this for thousands of years. And in Illinois, it's, coming back. So it's really important that we support these farmers, because it's a huge investment for them. And it's also in some cases like a 3-year project for them to be growing different varieties and to bring them back. And, the flavors that you get from it, you really will notice a difference with it. And then for us even, it's like, our customers have actually come in and they have varieties that they like better than others. And then I'm trying not to get them too hooked on one set, because it's so important for us to support the revitalizing the diversity.
If you're going to try and revitalize the grain economy here, do there need to be more Hewns? Meaning, if farmers are going to, like you said, a 3-year process, and they're going to invest in the idea of planting and harvesting organic wheat grains, do more need to come out of the woodwork to do the kind of from scratch bread making that you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are other bakeries in Chicago that are doing it really well as well. So we have some good partners that are doing this, but I think also larger scale, we need bigger places, right? Like places that are buying a ton, some of the chains that will look at investing in local wheat and making that a part of.
Will they do that? I mean, is it cost effective for them to do that?
Well, I think just the same as a lot of those places have transitioned into meats that are raised, hormone-free, grain is still going to be much cheaper for them to buy. So if they can make the transition to meat that's raised sustainably,
they can do
it with grains, and especially partnering with some farmers that would be willing to do it, and then getting bakeries to convert into that.
Ellen King's my guest. She's the co-owner and head baker at Hewn in Evanston. It's fascinating to me because I don't know much about it, and I'm just kind of leading with my curiosity here. But when you think of the big bread makers and people who are using wheat, I mean, is it the same as other production lines where they found a low cost, low non-organic wheat that's we don't want to know how it's made, that kind of thing? I mean, is there sort of a wholesale production when it comes to bread and when it comes to the big distributions that is happening in our area?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things with baking is, you know, a lot of people say it's a science, right? Like it's based on like very strict, you know, measurements and scale weights. And so it is a little more difficult for places that have had a formula for like their burger bun, right? To use local wheat. There's a little bit more variety and variance in the wheat. It can, you know, they do have spec sheets that are standardized, but it's a little bit more difficult when you're running like thousands of pounds and cranking out burger buns if you get a batch of a crop from one year that's a little bit different. So you have to always be kind of...
Consistency is important, right?
Yeah. So you need to have your bakers kind of adjust their formulas to the different wheat that'll be coming in each year. And in some cases, you know, that is cost, that costs the businesses. But at the same point, you look at people with gluten sensitivities, right? And a lot of this, there's talk about it. I'm not a doctor, but there's talk about it being from how the wheat's grown and what's sprayed on it and what we're ingesting as opposed to wheat that's sustainably grown.
Because it's been such an explosion of people who have gluten intolerance, not even disease, just intolerance to it. And there's a question of where that's coming from.
Exactly.
It's just, it's through the roof in terms of people.
Right. And this isn't like a crop like, you know, like the go-go berry from Brazil that no one's eaten Like this, we've eaten wheat our entire like human history basically for the last 7,000 years. And so for us to be having these sensitivities to it is definitely from something that we're doing. And when you look at the amount of synthetic inputs that are in a field of conventionally grown wheat, you start thinking like my body's actually reacting to toxins. Like it's doing what it should be doing. And so
that's an interesting point. Okay. I was reading all about Huhn today, and I had a couple of questions that I don't know much about bread making. It's really funny. The only experience I have with bread making is my friend from Seattle. Isn't that interesting? Like you said, you're from Seattle. I'm like, that must be a big thing there.
Yeah.
Because I went to visit him, and yeah, he had, was making bread out in his kitchen and the whole thing. He was really into it. I was like, wow, not a thing I knew about. So I'm interested in the starter. This is an area where I was reading in this concept that all the bread sort of comes from one starter. Tell me about that concept. When you're making artisanal bread, how important is it, and just what's the definition of a starter?
Yeah, so that is, some people get confused about it because people come in and say, I want to have a sourdough like San Francisco, and or they call, you know, there's different terms for it, starter, sourdough. And what it is it's wild yeast. It's basically flour and water that come together and then activate essentially the wild yeast that's on the flour in the air. And what that does is it acts as the leavener for your bread, but it also adds flavor and it helps to, you know, kind of alter the gluten structure as it ferments.
Is it your take on it? I mean, as an artist, I mean, that's where you can put your stamp in the starter that might be different than somebody else's?
I mean, no, I'm not that unique. Yes, mine, you know, it's like, yeah, totally. No, if once you've created your starter and if you're maintaining, I mean, the difference can come with when you use it. So it's like basically you feed your starter and then you can wait several hours to use it. And so it becomes like a level of ripeness. So think about it like aging wines, right? Like, or brandies or whatever, whiskey. And so you can consume it while it's really younger and it'll be a little bit sweeter, but still have that sour component. Or you could take it and have it be a lot more sour where it's adding more of that kind of almost acidic flavor, sour flavor. But we're not unique in that, but we do make sure all of our breads are naturally fermented with the starter. We don't ever add any instant yeast to it. Sometimes, you know, if the bread's not rising fast enough, some places will add a little dash of yeast to it to help give it a little oomph. And we don't do that. Sometimes it's, you know, it's like our bread is, you know, we have to take, it's going to take longer for it to ferment. And that's just kind of, you know, what we've signed up for and why our bread, we're so passionate about it. It's like every day, if you came into our bakery, you'd be like, do these people know what they're doing? Because it's like every day we're like, what's the temperature? What's this? What, you know, how long did you let this sit? What was the water temperature? Like we're asking these questions and people be like, do they have anything that they do the same every day?
Well, I mean, that's what's great about a bread shop. I mean, I don't necessarily want to walk in and for me to say, I'll have a little bit of Italian, the one with a little cheese on top, Italian, and the other one.
Yeah,
that's how we know bread in this area. But, you know, I want to ask you this because artisanal bread shops, and I would say that, you know, artisanal bread sandwich shops, really. You've seen this almost become a marketing trend, where in the last 10 years, 15 years, you've seen places that have been national chains that will put the grains and the bread in their branding and marketing, and they sort of are playing on the idea of this artisanal bread explosion where people want it. How do you as a shop in Evanston differentiate yourself to say, you know, it's not a gimmick, it's not sort of, you know, we're not just sort of riding the tide or the trend that big shops are sort of taken over?
Yeah, I mean, how do we counteract that with market? We don't really have a marketing budget for it, but we, you know, it's, I think when people come in and they see all the loaves that are literally shaped like slightly different, there's no uniformity except for it consistently tasting great. But the look of it is always a little, you know, irregular. Right. And some places that we've done some wholesale business with have been like, can you make this a little bit more, you know, perfect? And, you know, like, I think we've gotten used to that, right? Where we want this like artisan product, but at the same point, we want it to look exactly the same because, you know, that's what we're used to. And that's not what we can do. Yeah. And, you know, it's like the bake sometimes is a little darker. Sometimes it looks a little lighter. Sometimes our customers are not happy because the bake is a little darker. And, you know, it's literally us hand shaping and hand mixing and then putting it in the oven. We don't have a massive oven. So, you know, sometimes like a deck gets somehow, you know, forgotten for a few extra minutes. It is a little darker, you know.
Well, I mean, there's something great about it. I mean, just the concept of having a bread shop, it takes you back, especially, you know, when you think about the history of this area and being at one point, as you were saying in the break, along the Chicago River being sort of, you know, all about grain and the grain economy. It's great to have a connection to that. Is that big for you? Is that big to sort of be part of a movement to bring that economy back?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the farmers that have invested, they're the ones, they started this, you know, a few years ago. They're like the heroes. I'm kind of riding on their coattails, just taking their flour and doing hopefully tasty things with it. But I'm totally humbled because honestly, to be a farmer and to, you know, take a risk on growing organic grain and hoping that you're going to make the money in a few years is, for a business, like running a business, I don't know if I would be that courageous as they are to do that. So if I can help promote it, then that's awesome because I really am committed, yeah, to bringing back the local grain economy and supporting these farmers however we can. And, you know, there's actually a society of historians that I just at their conference there. It's the Society of Agricultural Historians. And there's a whole, like, contingent of professors that teach agricultural history. And it's really amazing when you start learning like how applicable what they learn is applying it in modern day. So I feel like being bridging the gap between a baker and a historian is pretty amazing.
That's great. Ellen King is the head baker and co-owner of Hewn, H-E-W-N, the bread shop in Evanston. She's my guest tonight, Industry Night. Ellen, thanks so much for coming in and talking about the history and sharing how we make bread.
Thanks for having me.
W. Kamau Bell coming up here at 9:30. Beautiful night on Michigan Avenue. They had a thunderstorm warning for the area, but they canceled it. So nice to see everyone walk by. I think it's such a small world. You know who just walked by and waved in the window?
No.
My parents.
Just walking around the city?
Yeah.
Taking it in the evening?
Yeah, I didn't know they were down here.
Hmm. You know, that's
little,
it.
That didn't dwell.
Not dropping by.
Yeah, they didn't say that. I want to come in. I want to see you. It was just more of like a. I don't even think they stopped like stride. They just were like, hey. It's kind of weird. Like, no, let's not bother him. But also, we don't care. Oh, he saw us. Put the hand up. We'll wave.
Hey, man, don't feel bad. Mine usually pick up speed. Hey, Mom.
Mom,
Dad,
where you going?
Come on, man.
All right. W. Kamau Bell coming up. And also Panda Riot Live in Studio 435. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a comedian, writer, television host. W. Kamau Bell is the host of the Emmy-nominated CNN show United Shades of America, which is currently in its second season.
To get a better understanding of what life is like in these neighborhoods, Malika set up a meeting between me and current affiliated gang members. I'm totally not scared. Okay, I'm a little scared.
This is Wild Wild the General.
Of course, you know, nice to meet you, brother.
Nice to meet you, brother. Wild Wild the General is the leader of his crew, the Pirate Gang, here in Altgeld Gardens, reportedly one of the hottest pockets of violence on the south side of Chicago. And if you know me, you know I hate hot pockets.
About a week ago, it was just two killers out here, you know, two shootings, people died. It may look like it look now, but
yeah. It
ain't sweet. Trust me, this is one of the most infamous projects. It's chaos, man.
I feel like you just invoked the thunder.
That's that force. That was the verification.
Yeah, okay,
you know?
Yeah, you got
no validation
that's
needed.
The blue check mark. You got verified.
Yeah, okay. Man.
Nationally, when people talk about Chicago right now, it's like the most notorious city in the country. People talk about the South Side and the West Side and gangs. Do you think it's worse than people think it is, or is it exaggerated?
It's worse.
Bell is not just a personality, but he's a media empire. He's got his own show on CNN, several great podcasts, just wrote the book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, Tales of a 6'4", African-American, heterosexual, cisgender, left-leaning, asthmatic, black and proud, blurred, mama's boy, dad, and stand-up comedian. W. Kamau Bell, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Oh, is there time for an interview now? That intro was so thorough.
Right. I've been a fan of yours, and I love Totally Biased and have known your work for a long time. When you have the show you have now on CNN, how much of that is a direct evolution to what you were doing on stage coming up as a stand-up?
I mean, I think this is, it feels like, in some sense, I mean, not everybody is guaranteed a TV show and show business, so I feel lucky that I got that, immensely lucky, but it's just an extension of what I was already doing. Like, I think that, you know, I was on stage talking about issues and talking about how do we solve these things and pointing out the ridiculous parts, but also trying to be pretty sensitive about it and trying to be respectful. And the show is trying to do all those things too. And, you know, the difference is for me, the whole point of the show is to hand over the mic to other people and go, you tell your story. Yeah. I'll listen to your story and try to support it through either ridiculous jokes I make or through, you know, sort of facts and figures that we use to wrap around these interviews so people can, like, so that the audience can go, is this real? Oh, yeah, it is real.
I mean, you have taken some of the positive aspects of Totally Biased and brought it to United Shades, mostly the man on the street aspect. Talk about that. Talk about what you learned from doing the man on the street bits with Totally Biased and how you use it for United Shades.
I mean, thankfully, you know, thank you, Black Jesus. When I say Black Jesus, of course, I mean Chris Rock. Chris Rock for giving me the opportunity to do that on the show and for understanding that, like, it was his idea. You got to go do man on the street stuff. You got to go meet the people. Like, that was his idea. That was not something we pitched the show with. And I was nervous about it because I felt like all the man on the street stuff I'd seen was people making fun of people. And I was like, didn't want to do that. And luckily, I developed my own style. And then when the show got canceled, the overwhelming feedback I got was the thing that people liked the most about my contribution to the show was the man on the street stuff. And so knowing that, when there was this idea for the CNN show that got pitched to me because they pitched the idea before I was a part of it, I was like, oh, that's the same thing, just a more developed version of that. So thankfully, I think I always would have liked to have a show like this, but with Totally Biased and FX giving me the reps to learn on the job, I sort of walked into United Shades much more prepared.
How do you make that experience authentic? Because, you know, you've got a camera crew and you got microphones, and you see a little bit of that in your show. I love that you'll see the camera crew and the sound guy in the shot in some cases, in the Chicago episode, you know, where someone is calling you over. But how do you make sure that that's authentic? Because a lot of times people are going to clam up, or they're going to maybe not say the things that they really want to say because they're nervous that there's a camera in front of them. What's the secret to making that an authentic experience?
I mean, there's a lot that goes into that. One is having a camera crew that knows how to be invisible. You know, like that even though people can see the camera crews all around, that they know how to sort of, like, you know, there's different ways camera crews do it. Some camera crews are like, okay, you stand over there. Now be quiet. Okay, now move. And there's that way. And our camera crew's not like that at all. They're like, hi, my name is Patrick. I'll be shooting you today with the camera. Ha, ha, ha. Like, they're very, like, is this comfortable? Can you sit here? Is that chair good? Do you need a different chair? Like, it's, like, really making it clear that the experience is about their version of the experience, not the entertainment industry version of the experience. Making sure that the person being interviewed and talked to knows that you're the most important person here. So making sure so it's really about, like, you need water, do you want a Coke? You know, sort of, and once people realize that you're thinking about them and not just thinking about getting the right lighting and the right shot, they loosen up. And then it's also about me like really sort of engaging them before the cameras roll, just to let them know I'm not there just to sort of get their camera part of them. Right. I want to like, hey, how you doing? Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it. You know, want to make sure that you're comfortable. This is what we're going to do. I might make some jokes and sort of so that they're already talking to you before the camera rolls. And so by the time the camera rolls, you're already in the middle of something. And then the last thing is like when you leave, make sure you leave the place better than you found it. You know, like I think it's really important to like, put things back where they belong. Make sure you wipe down that dusty table that person never wiped down. You know, really sort of, as the showrunner, Donnie Jackson, says, it's important that people know that we're lucky that they want to talk to us, not the other way around. Not that they're lucky that we want to talk to them.
As a comedian, as someone who, you know, is great on your feet and you're able to improvise and come up with jokes in the moment, what's the challenge? I mean, because in United Shades, and what is really great about the show is that, yes, you are funny, but really it's about getting the information out of these people. And sometimes it's compelling information that sometimes maybe a joke would squash. As a comedian, How difficult is it for you to adjust and be in a position where you're half journalist, half comedian, and letting people breathe?
I mean, for me, I think I don't think of myself as a journalist, so that helps. Like, I think that I certainly hear the accusation that I'm a journalist because I'm on CNN and I'm doing things that have journalistic qualities.
Okay, documentary. How about documentarian?
Yeah, I feel like I'm closer to that, like some sort of 21st century documentarian. But I think the big thing is like understanding that the number one thing I bring to the table is listening. And so that even if I have a joke, but it's in the middle of the person still talking, like you go, oh man, if they stop talking now, I'd have a good joke. Don't interrupt them. Like that's the number one thing. Don't interrupt them. And then by the time you get to the end of that thing, if you go, oh, that joke might still work, then say the joke. But then also you have time to sort of weigh that joke. Is this really a good joke? Or is this too much? And, da, 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 da. And then sometimes if you feel like you went too far, like even some of this you see this on camera, I'll make a joke and the person goes, ha, 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 and then making fun of myself for making that joke sometimes which we do on the show. Right. Showing how the sausage gets made. Like, oops, that was a step too far. You know what I mean? Like sort of owning the fact that that I'm not perfect. And I think that's a big part of it too. Is so that if you make the wrong joke, sort of going, that was the wrong joke, you know, and I think that the people you're talking to appreciate that. And the watchers, the people who watch the show often appreciate that. I'm sort of a reliable narrator because I'm not telling you that I have all the answers.
Right. W. Kamau Bell is the host of United Shades of America, which is in the second season on CNN. It airs on Sunday night. Also, so many other projects. I want to get to that. But the Chicago episode that you had in season two, it just aired in May. You point out that you spent time here. You spent your teenage years here in Chicago, lived down in Hyde Park. Talk about how important it was for you to tell Chicago's story by having Chicago be part of your story.
Well, it sort of revealed itself to be important to me because the first season, you know, Chicago's always in the news, and especially in the last few years with all the crime stats and reporting that people all over the country use to sort of demonize Chicago. And as somebody who lived in Hyde Park and then lived on the north side, and really when I moved to the Bay Area, I was really homesick for Chicago a lot. I have a lot of like love for Chicago and still do, and go back regularly. I mean, this will be like the third time in the last 6 months that I've been there. So it was sort of like, I know that Chicago is not just one thing like the media reports. And then, but on top of that, people who don't know me who would see like, oh, you'll talk to the Klan, but you won't go talk to gang members in Chicago about gangs. You won't do that. You won't go to the west side of Chicago to talk to. I was like, and it was just funny to be like, oh, you have no idea that I graduated from high school in Chicago. Like, you have no idea.
Right.
You need to get to Wikipedia and read about me. And so for me, the second season, and then combine that with Trump demonizing Chicago pretty regularly and then targeting Dwayne Wade's niece with a tweet to sort of try to get black people to vote for him, I was just like, we have to do Chicago. It was the first episode we shot of the new season. And as we sort of pitched, like, what should we do? There was like a handful of like, we have to do this. And Chicago was one of those. So, and then luckily, you know, our showrunner, Donnie Jackson, this was his first year on the show, he knew a lot of people that we could talk to. And he reached out to people like Malik Youssef, who's in the episode, who's a music producer and also grew up in gangs. Like, he reached out to him and he helped us get to a lot of people we wouldn't have gotten to otherwise. So it's really like the benefit of those people who are those connectors really helped us make that episode. And I'm really proud of that episode. And I still, you know, I saw a lot of those guys who were affiliated with gangs came to a screening we did at the Boys and Girls Club and stood up and met people and talked to people about, like, these teenagers, these kids at the Boys and Girls Club about their lives.
What surprised you about that episode? I mean, being from here, and it's been a couple of years, but what surprised you about the story you were telling about Chicago gangs?
The surprise, and we put this in the episode, was that everybody has the answers. everybody on the south and west side that we talked to, without fail, there was nobody that you went, how could we fix this? Who was like, I have no idea. Everybody was like, their answers were, we need jobs and we need better schools. And then third was like, and we need better cops. Like, they were like, sort of like, the cop thing was like, it's important, but really they were more focused on their immediate family's needs, like jobs and schools. And so at the same time you're saying schools, that you know that Mayor Emanuel has closed all those schools in the most sort of deprived neighborhoods. It's like, you know, these people are like, we need those schools back, and we need those schools to be better than they were when they were here. Everybody, the most hardcore gang member we talked to was like, yeah, we need better schools for our kids. This gang life is not what it's cracked up to be. It's not the life that I would like if I could do things differently.
You've had such a great career, and it continues, but totally biased on FX and the stand-up stuff and what you do with your podcast as well. I think about the career of an entertainer, especially someone who is going to be in social and political commentary. You have to learn from each project. And you have to also recognize that each project's, even the best TV shows that we know, are 3, 4, 5 years long. And those are the best ones that you have. Talk about being in this business and learning from the projects that you've done before and how it helps you evolve as not only a comedian, but as an entertainer.
You know, I for me, it's like, you know, in the current era, this is the really important thing. It's just about, I realize now that I use my career as a way to build communities and to make myself smarter. It's a very selfish thing. Like, it's not as much as people want to put me out there. It's like, he's doing all this, you know, some people say he's doing all this important or good work or whatever you want to call it. For me, it's like, I like when I know more people. I like when I know more different types of people. I like when I feel like more people have my back and I can get more people's backs. And I like when we're all connected. And so to do an episode in Appalachia where it's like, you go, I bet you wouldn't go talk to white people in Appalachia. Yeah, I'll go do that. Let's see if we can build some community. I just think it's really selfish. Like, I think about my kids. Like, I want the world to be better for them than it was for me. And at some point, I thought that was going to be easy. But now I'm like, wait a minute. This could get a lot worse for them than it was for me. So for me, it's like, as a comedian, I like talking to people, and I like making people laugh, and I like connecting with people. So this is just all an extension of that. And like I said, it's very selfish to me to be like, let's make the world a better place so I can have a better time in the world.
W. Kamau Bell will be at the Park West coming up this Friday, the 16th. He's also the host of United Shades of America on CNN and the author of The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, Tales of a 6'4 African-American, Heterosexual, Cisgender, Left-Leaning, Asthmatic, Black and Proud, Blurred, Mama's Boy, Dad, and Stand-Up Comedian. W. Kamau Bell will be at the Park West coming up on Friday. They moved that show. It was supposed to be at the Vic, and they moved it to Park West. I mean, you're in one crowded neighborhood with no parking or another, right? I love both those places. I've had the good fortune of being in both audiences at different times. Not for W. Kamau Bell. I performed on the Park West stage a couple times. And the Vic, I was part of a short film. Remember the show Image Union?
Yeah.
It was like an indie film kind of thing. Well, they had, every year they would have a best of the year kind of thing. And one of our short films for Schadenfreude got picked. And we were in the lineup of, like, I remember the one right before us was Ewan McGregor.
Wow.
And then we were after it. And it was like, so they did it at the Vic. And, you know, if you ever go to Bruin View at the Vic, they put that big screen up there. So it was kind of awesome that they showed our little, you know, illegal short film on the stage. We shot it in grocery stores. It was called Foodie Mart. And the joke was, we were all grocery store managers, but it was like Casino. Like, that was, it was sort of like a parody of Casino. So it's just sort of like, you know, the real hardcore stuff that happens at the Jewel, you know, instead of it being the, you know, the Tangiers or whatever it was. And so we even did a, you know, the soundtrack, everything. It was before there was so much licensing. So like we could play the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
But the best part is we shot it in grocery stores. So real grocery stores. We went to Jewel. And what we did was I would dress like a grocery store manager and having the slacks and the shirt and the tie and the and we would just go into aisle 14 and start shooting. So they'd shoot a scene, you know, and if it took a couple minutes, we had a whole plan planned out. This was years ago. And you would hear, Jake, do we got a problem with his customer service? you know, like that kind of thing. And you knew that here comes the manager, right? So the manager would come by and you would just say, we're just Columbia College students. Like that was the excuse. And they go, well, you can't shoot in here. And you're like, oh, we can't? We didn't know. We pack up.
Go to the next
and we
just
go to the next Jewel. They all look the same. And so we had a pattern of where we were on the north side. We could hit every Jewel. So that night we just did an all-nighter and we did seven or eight Jewels.
And get kicked out of each one?
Yeah. I mean, we just, towards the end, you're like, all right, we know we're going to get kicked out. But it was fun. And then that plus the Rolling Stones music that we use, it's just a shot away.
Yeah, they're probably just sour on that.
Yeah, now I feel like, yeah, they would probably take it down from YouTube. But this was pre-YouTube. This was 2000.
Ahead of your time.
Ahead of our time. 15 minutes ahead of my time. That's what I like to say. Coming up, Studio 435 tonight. Very excited to have Panda Riot in studio. They are setting up. There's you know me, I'm a big fan of the electronic. You know, we've had a couple bands in here in the last couple weeks that have been really pushing the this is dream pop.
Mm-hmm.
This is different than what it was. We were talking about it last time with I forgot the name of the band, but the last conversation we had was about synths and electronica music, and it was really interesting. So dream pop, I'm ready. I'm ready for dream pop.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I know, right? Not only are we going to hear it, but we're going to find out all about like what it is. We're going to have an intellectual conversation about dream pop. Right? I'm not going to let the band off the hook. They're one of the bands that I really like them, but I also like that they went straight at this is the category that we're in. We're the dream pop band, Panda Riot. Whereas, you know, you ask somebody, what genre are you guys?
Yeah, they don't want to pigeonhole.
We're music.
Mm-hmm.
We plug in. You know, and then you're like, oh, so now, but now we're going to go right at dream pop. So that's coming up. It'll be fun. Tomorrow night, the directors and writers of the new movie Rough Night.
Yeah.
With Scarlett Johansson. They're going to be at the big table. Paul Downs, Lucia Aniello are the writers and directors of the movie, and they're also known for their work on Broad City on Comedy Central. They direct episodes. They're on the writing staff, and so we'll talk to them about. I'm excited to have them. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's like celebrities,
that's a huge movie that's coming out this weekend. That'll be like one of the.
It will
big...
take down Guardians and Wonder Woman. Finally,
maybe I don't know about that. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. That's a little crazy to start talking like that. But yeah. But, yeah, I'm excited. I mean, I saw the movie, which is great. You know, it's a bachelorette party gone wrong. Always good. Always good for some laughs when you throw Kate McKinnon in with an Australian accent.
Yeah, the cast is pretty...
You got Jillian Bell. You've got Kate McKinnon. You've got Zoe Kravitz.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Ilana Glazer from Broad City. And then Scarlett Johansson is the main character. And then Paul Downs and a couple of the guys... kind of are on this. Paul Downs is one of the writers, directors who plays Abby's boss at the Soul Cycle. Is it Soul? What is it? Soul? It's not, I forgot the what they call it, but if you watch the show,
her gym
yeah, where she works
cleans,
at the gym.
Yeah.
And, yeah. it's on the tip of my tongue. Soul. It's not Soul Cycle is what they're parodying, right? It's like Soul something. It's really good. Anyway. Paul Downs plays that character, the boss. Abby.
Can't wait.
Yeah, so that's tomorrow night. All right, coming up here in Studio 435, Panda Riot. All right. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in our Allstate Showcase Studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight we go dream pop. The sounds of the band Panda Riot, the Chicago band by way of Philadelphia, just released a brand new album called Infinity Maps just this last week. The band is about to head out on tour. They got Detroit, Philly, New York, and Boston. Great, great rock and roll towns. And we'll be back here in Chicago on July 8th at the First Ward Chop Shop in Wicker Park. The band is Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne, and they are here. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate
it. Thanks for having us.
This is great. I really enjoy the record. I'm looking forward to hearing some of the Dream Pop. And as I sort of, as advertised,
yeah.
I kind of talked about this a little bit early in the hour. Let's talk about Dream Pop. Let's just start it off. That's what you guys have on your Twitter handle. Yeah. That's your setup in your bio. What is Dream Pop?
You know,
it's
I guess an offshoot of the whole shoegaze genre that was really popular or reached peak popularity for a while back in the 90s.
This would be like My Bloody Valentine, yeah, those kind of bands.
Yeah, exactly. Lush, all that kind of things. And, you know, there have been a lot of American bands that have kind of stayed the course and kept that going throughout the years since the 90s. It's kind of cool now because you've got like some of the old titans like MBV, Slowdive, Ride's putting out a new album. I think Swerve Driver's coming through town again. Coming back after 20 years and really getting a lot of attention and bringing it back into the scene. So, you know, you kind of feel vindicated if you've been doing it for a while, you know? So, I mean, it's just a lot of fun. I think it's accessible to a lot of people, relate to it because it has that pop sensibility, but it's a little deeper, a little bit more psychedelic maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, tell me about the instrumentation of it. I mean, when you talk about Dream Pop, because I see as you guys are setting up and I know from listening to the record, you know, percussions play a big part in what you guys are trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like most of it, it's like more or less like a basic drum, like just patterns, nothing too crazy. But then it gets deeper, more or less like what other artists like, I guess with the like Swerve Driver to get more aggressive and stuff. So yeah, it definitely has its highs and lows.
I mean, I think in general something that sets the genre apart is just the idea of perspective in a mix. Like, so typically when you hear a pop song, the vocal is going to be way up front. So that's the information that everybody pays attention to. And treating the vocals as an instrument already makes it dreamier. Just, you know,
yeah, right.
If you're a folk band.
That's an interesting,
you do that.
Yeah, that's yeah. interesting. I guess that's a great example. I think about the music and I think about that, the bands that you've mentioned. It is true. Like the vocals almost feel like another, and they feel like a guitar. They feel like another part. They're not up front, and everything else is muted behind it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and a lot of times we there's always vocal melodies that are pop melodies, but then we also have like on the album there's some reverse vocal parts, or like sometimes where we take like my voice and put it into a sampler and like chop up the sounds and literally make the vocals into an instrument
right.
Where it was like you know, there's no way, you know, when we're talking about like, okay, now we're going to play this live, it's like, I can't do some like Twin Peaks thing and like sing it backwards or something, you know, like that's not going to happen. So like there's certain times when like the voice like literally is an instrument.
Kind of like Bobby McFerrin, I'd say.
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
But not at all.
Right.
Not really.
For I mean, when you talk, let's talk about the ability to produce the music. I mean, if you were going to get into the idea of dream pop or the shoegazing music, where is there a level of production, that skill that you need to be able to pull that kind of thing off? You're talking about reversing the lyrics and putting them through samples, or the idea of a different kind of mix where the vocals are not sort of front and center. Does it take a different kind of approach to production?
I mean, I think definitely it depends how deep you want to go with your music, but we work with a lot of layers, and that is definitely something where you have to, it's puzzle pieces, you know, you have to say like, okay, you know, how big is the guitar sound? Like, where's that going to fit in?
Yeah.
Can we have too many instruments? And if we have too many instruments, does it add up to nothing? Because it's too much chaotic stuff. So there's definitely a line there.
And you should just say like how many tracks?
Yeah, how many tracks
are on a song?
This is misleading.
Insane.
This is misleading. on an average song, maybe like 172.
What?
But that's what
172
that is.
Tracks.
Right. But what that is like taking the same instrument, like a guitar, one guitar take, yeah, and throwing it through like five different amps, and then you take that another guitar take. So there you have 15. So you can imagine,
right? It's math.
So it's just
infinity.
So it's a bunch of texture that you can do. Like, you ever see, like, you know, when you play a drawbar organ, okay, and you have like Paul Schaefer,
Yeah.
So imagine if they're all guitars and you just each one has a slightly different tone.
See, there's a big part. I mean, they talk about hundreds and hundreds of tracks. I mean, I think you start to get a better picture of what makes dream pop kind of come alive. The mm-hmm. idea that you are putting so much into replicating and even affecting the same source music. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's a one piece of music, it's one guitar track, but what you're doing is you're layering it to give it a sound that you're not going to replicate, like you said, on stage.
Right. It's trying to have one foot in reality of a live band and another foot in something, I don't want to say like beyond that, like, but you know, mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's like that. Well, with technology in general, you can like create things that just couldn't exist in the normal, like, I don't know, 3D, 4D world or whatever.
Right, right.
Unless you have a lot of band members.
Yeah right. Which
a
makes
lot,
it more
175 band.
You can
members.
Make which makes it a lot more impressive when you think about the things that Ride and other bands pulled off in the mid 90s.
Right.
You know, with stuff where maybe they were still using different kind of even. I don't even know if you're in digital tape at that point.
They would just have huge racks.
There was still a lot of reel-to-reel involved with that. And, you know, you're talking the early guys like Alan Moulder and stuff like that, who were pioneers coming off of the old rock, you know what I mean? But with everything that's available now in terms of being able to play live and really just create those textures, that's mm-hmm. what I think is usually what people will sit there and kind of use to decide what follows under the auspices of what. But if you're ever on like social media at all and in a dream pop fan group, you'll see a lot of people debating for days, like, does this qualify? You know, and you're just kind of like, I I'm just glad that some people like us and, you know, well, that we made the cut.
Let's do this. Cool. Let's take a quick break.
Okay.
We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation. And then we'll, after the news, we'll hear some live music in Studio 435. The band Panda Riot in studio tonight. Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne. They are playing on July 8th at the Chop Shop Chop Shop First Ward in Wicker Park. Let's take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. All right, welcome back. Studio 435 here on The Download. The band Panda Riot is in studio with me. That's Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne. They are playing on July 8th at the Chop Shop, First Ward in Wicker Park. This week, they're going to be heading out on tour supporting their brand new album, Infinity Maps, Detroit, Philly, New York, and Boston. Yeah!
Boom.
Rock City.
We pick up where we were just where we left off about, you know, creating dream pop in the studio and that contrast about playing it on stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a lot of people, as you guys develop a sound that you like in studio, what is the philosophy about bringing it to stage? Do you try to replicate it? Do you automatically have to think about performing differently? I mean, talk about what goes into taking what you guys do in studio and translating it to the stage.
I would just say, I think we all agree, there's a big difference between kind of like isolated headphone listening by like as an individual and being in a sense of, you know, at a show and with other people and in the moment and the idea that you can't rewind it. So I would say we kind of try to go for more physicality live rather than like nuance, mm-hmm. you know, because the nuance is, you know, maybe lost in the translation of the room, what have you.
Do you have to learn that as a dream pop musician? Do you have to learn as you guys get more experience that, you know, early on in your career where you're like, oh, we're going to go right to stage with this track? And I mean, talk about the learned behavior of going from studio to stage.
Well, it definitely has been like a long evolving process. When Brian and I first started, this is like embarrassing story that I'll just like tell anyway. we didn't know what we were doing at all. And I had like, I was playing a keyboard and I had like this like big, heavy 88 key, like weighted key Yamaha keyboard that
this
I like brought,
story,
brought to the show because it was like the keyboard that we had. But then we've come a long way since then. Right, right. And like thinking back on it, it's pretty funny. But so it's definitely been a learning process and figuring out how to, because we have electronic drums and live drums. Right. That was really tough, like figuring out how to have that translate live. And we, you know, we experimented with a bunch of different, like, you know, configurations of which drums. We ended up with, like, Jose plays a much more like scaled down kit, mm-hmm. so that it can mm-hmm. fit in with the electronic drums rather than having like a full kit alongside electronic drums.
Do you have to learn that to complement and accompany the electronics?
Yeah, I mean, I'm like traditionally just like a regular like full kit drummer, so to really like minimize my playing, that kind of was like, I was bummed out, but
it was insulting.
I was like, how dare you guys? But if you're a good drummer, you kind of know how to like work around it and just have fun with it. And, you know, I feel like at the end of it, I was just like, all right, I could do this. So,
well, I mean, in a way, as a band that has, you know, you put so much into what you do in the studio.
Yeah.
It gives you an opportunity to have a dual personality, to be able to have two outlets, if mm-hmm. you will, to have the studio on the stage. Do you guys take full advantage of that? I mean, do you think about that when you're writing a song and you put that song together? Are you in your head already thinking, this is how it's going to sound on the record and this is how it's going to sound on the stage?
I think that, I mean, there's room for both. If you look at the new record, there's so many tracks on there. I think it's 18 tracks that really we could do live, but really I think are best, like you said, kind of on your own, listening to with a good speakers or good headphones on or something like that. I've always believed that when you come in, you know, when you're playing live, people shouldn't be able to talk over you. You know what I mean? You've got the amps, you've got the mic, you know, so we like to, I think, you know, I've tried to emphasize as much as we can, like, you know, when we're translating this stuff that, you know, we come in and work on, well, the nice thing is we practice in our studio. So, I mean,
right.
You know, yeah, it's right. It's easy to kind of test some of those feels and kind of see what works, what doesn't work quite as well. And you kind of, you know, go from there. So
do you guys as a band, do you have a philosophy on how honest you want to be with that track? Meaning, do you think about that? You're like, well, this, you know, we sold this track on the record and it's got all this great stuff on it that we were tinkering with. Mm-hmm. We need to deliver that to the audience on stage. Or are you like, we just already know that's not going to be there and we're going to find a different way to approach it?
I don't know. I don't know if it's necessarily a bad thing that not everything is always performed. Sometimes, like, there's certain songs that could just be your own. It's weird to hear a song that you really, really like, and then you go see a show with a bunch of other people that you've never seen, and they all really, really like it. And there's something good about that, but there's also something kind of sad about that.
That's truth, man. Yeah. That's right. That is truth. But, that's honesty.
So, yeah. So
I don't want to like what you like.
Well, no. But there's something like it's like your own. You know, it's your own. And, like, to be in a communal space with it is odd. I would feel worse if we tried to translate stuff that would just not translate. Yeah, right. You know?
Well, I've always wondered, like, as artists, as you create the music that's going to be on a new record or that's you're going to tour with, mm-hmm. just how you approach the song. Is it the demo that you guys put together that you say, this is the song, this is what we're doing? Is it the production that you guys do, the 170 tracks in studio? Is it the, which is amazing. Trust me, as someone who's proficient on Pro Tools and understands it, I mean, it's amazing to think that you're going that deep with the music. Yeah. And impressive. Or is it, you know, sort of the energy and the feel that you have in this sort of connection with the audience that's in the space? What is the ultimate experience for you guys when it comes to writing a song?
It's like just like the energy, because it's like, you know, like whenever you like start on a new song, you're excited, you know, you're kind of like, all right, you know, it's, you know, like whether it is like doing like the guitar or like the drum work or the bass line or just the vocals. I mean, like whenever I do my drum parts, I'm like excited just to share something that's new. That's kind of like, all right, no one else is going to hear yet. But then it just evolves and takes shape along the way. And it's like, it's just wonderful, you know?
And yeah. And I think like the songs are kind of, or most of the songs other than the little instrumental songs, like the more like pop songs, I think they kind of function at two levels at the same time. Like there's something about the songs where there's like, we kind of like to think, like, if you can strip the song down to just like the guitar and the vocals or something, and it's still a good song, yeah, then that right. means that it's like really good.
Right.
So it's like, it kind of, I feel like the song's always like, we never want to like hide behind like a lot of layers and stuff, you know, to make it, oh, we added all these textures to hide the fact that really like it's a crappy melody or something, you know? Like, so I think that like the songs that we try to write are songs that are always going to function at like in multiple contexts.
Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne in studio. They are the band Panda Riot. They got a new album out called Infinity Maps, and they're going to be heading out on tour this week, Detroit, Philly, New York, Boston, and they'll be back in Chicago on July 8th at First Ward Chop Shop in Wicker Park. All right, let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll sound check in the break, and we will get some live music here in Studio 435 from Panda Riot. Stay with us. All right. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. It's Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight is no different as we go dream pop, the sounds of the band Panda Riot, the Chicago band by way of Philadelphia, just released a new album called Infinity Maps. They are Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne, and they are ready to play live here in Studio 435. Here is the track Helios. Take it away. Yes, there you go. I love it. Listen to that. Helios, the name of the track. The band Panda Riot in studio. They are going out on tour this week. They're going to be in Detroit, Philly, New York, Boston. They'll be back here in Chicago on July 8th at First Ward Chop Shop in Wicker Park. The band, Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get some more live music here with Panda Riot in Studio 435. Stay with us. It's Studio 435 here on the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, the band Panda Riot. They are going to be at the Chop Shop on July 8th. That's the Chop Shop First Ward in Wicker Park. The band, Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne are in studio tonight. They are playing music before they head out on tour. They're supporting their album, Infinity Maps. So let's get right back to it. Here they are live in Studio 435 with the track Gold Lines. Take it away, guys.
Wish I could go away. Oh,
Yeah. Woo! The band Panda Riot in Studio 435 tonight. They're going to be playing at the Chop Shop, First Ward in Wicker Park on July 8th. They are just released their brand new album, Infinity Maps, last week. And you know what we're going to do? We're going to go right back into our last track. The band is Rebecca Scott, Brian Cook, Jose Alejandro Rodriguez, and Corey Osborne. Very excited. Here is the last track we're going to have tonight in Studio 435. It's a twofer, as they say in the business. Here is the track, Arrows. Take it away, guys.
Thank you.
You can feel the energy in here, the sweat. Yeah, I love it. The sweat is real. Panda Riot, Chicago's Panda Riot, playing a little Dream Pop in Studio 435 tonight. They're going to be at the First Ward Chop Shop in Wicker Park on July 8th. This week they're heading out to Detroit, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. Good luck on that tour, guys. You also, the album Infinity Maps is out now. I can't thank you enough for being here in Studio 435. You guys are great.
Thanks so much, guys. That was a blast.
That's going to do it tonight for the download. Very exciting. What a night. Panda Riot was great. There we go. All right, coming up tomorrow on the show, the writers and directors of the movie Rough Night with Scarlett Johansson are going to be in studio at the big table. Paul Downs and Lucia Agnello. I'm excited to talk with them because they are both writers and directors of Broad City as well on Comedy Central. So they will be with us tomorrow night. Also, Andrea Levoff and a brand new segment, The Download on Business, which is coming up tomorrow night. Sponsored by Signature Bank. So that's coming up tomorrow night on The Download.